2, Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack the Sun. Welcome to the 293rd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 292 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles daily from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. And once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some announcements. First, personal. My latest group, The Trump File, a short collection of poems dating back to 2009, and a short story, all revealing my feelings for the present occupant of the White House, is now available on Amazon, both in print and in Kindle formats. Additionally, I'm in the middle of editing the Hudson Valley Anthology 2019, a collection of the writing of slightly of 60 of today's writers. I am shooting for its release anytime from the end of September to early October. Then now, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 23rd year. Usually at 6:30 p.m. in Mahopac Library on Route 6 in Mahopac, surprisingly. More than 175 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also had a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So October's meeting will be on Wednesday, October 16th, at 10 a.m. at the Hill Boulevard Diner, which is on Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley. There are also two poetry workshops in the area open to both the fledgling and experienced poets, one in Mahopac and in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month in Mahopac Library at 6:30 p.m., and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Troubadour, New York, at 6 p.m. In September, the Mahopac workshop already met on September 11th and will next meet on Wednesday, October the 9th, while the Yorktown one will meet this Wednesday, September 25th. Finally, the October open mic session of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center will be held on Friday, October 18th in the scenic Calypso Manor train station overlooking the Hudson in Sleepy Hollow, New York. A complete guide to all the center's many offerings can be found at writerscenter.org. That's writerscenter, one word, WRITERSCENTR.org. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. My guest on next week's show will be an old friend, documentary producer, agricultural economist, and consultant to foreign governments, Charles Chipman. Chip has just released DVDs of his multimedia history of the early days of personal computing called Power Sharing. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 293rd show. Tonight, I am joined by writer, editor, and blogger Mike DeLucia. I saw Mike's latest book, Madness, when it was announced, and ordered immediately thinking that I had been the only person in Westchester County who knew who Hank Lucetti was. Hopefully, by the end of this show, many more people will. The listeners wishing to join Mike and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call of participation until near the end of my conversation with host. But let's get started. Good evening, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Good evening. Good evening. It's great to be here.
But where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in the Bronx, New York, neighborhood. It was like, it's called the Pelham Bay Throgs Neck section of the Bronx. And I went to school. I went to a Catholic school called St. Benedict's from first to eighth grade.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
Early on, I think originally I wanted to be a teacher, and then I wanted to be an actor because there was a dynamic teacher in the school, Ron McFarland, who put on a rock and roll musical. Well, back then it was Godspell, and my classmates, you know, were in it, and I went out there and I saw this, and I was absolutely amazed at that kids can do this kind of thing. I mean, it was just incredible, and I said, that's what I want to do. So I wanted to do that, and then I wanted to be a teacher, and then I wanted to be an actor again, and I went, and then I went to school for that, and so on and so forth, but yeah.
Were you an early reader?
Honestly, no. I didn't develop, you know, as a reader until I got older. My father he bought this library. My mother and father were not college educated, and my father bought all of these books for us, and he wanted us to read these books, and he used to he bought these machines for us, these, you know, that would, you know, like text would scroll across, and then, you know, to help you, you know, read faster, and then there'd be questions on comprehension in it. It just kind of, it turned me off to it, and it was also kind of like the, you know, the smoker, you know, who's telling his child, you know, with a cigarette in his mouth, you know, don't smoke. You know, my father wasn't a reader, my mom wasn't a reader, and, you know, they wanted us to read, and then, you know, it just kind of left a bad taste in my mouth. I didn't discover reading until I got older, really out of high school. I didn't start, you know, writing. I kind of got into a little bit early. It's funny. In St. Benedict's had an awful teacher, Miss Hurley. She was terrible. I wrote this thing one time, you had to write about a creative writing about something I forgot, but I wrote about picnic food, and I wrote about watermelon, and I wrote about hamburgers, and it was really good. It was in the sixth grade, and she gave it back. I was so proud of it, and she gave it back to me with like a C or a D, and she said, next time, do your own work. And
wow.
Yeah, and I'm telling you this now, I remember the look on her face, you know, as she looked at me, and that was my first kind of writing. But reading didn't happen for me until I got a little bit older. You know, it was really out of high school.
I had one like that. I was in seventh grade and was supposed to write about something, and I just started in the middle of the year, toward the end of it, in this Catholic boarding school, and I wrote something. It was a sports thing about Joe DiMaggio's last year, and I said, and the question is, to what happens next year? Talk about an answer, DiMaggio. And I got it back to me, and I was asked where I had copied this from, and I said, no place, you know. But he believed me after I said that. I went to college with a lot of people from Throg's Neck. Most of my friends from there, they're athletes or sports fans. Can you describe your childhood there for games and the like?
Yeah, sure. I mean, growing up in the Bronx, I have to say, is a childhood that I wish my own kids had. You know, we left the Bronx when they were very young. When I grew up, it was all kinds of street games. You know, we played Scully, and we played, you know, Ringolivio, and Johnny on the Pony, and we played, you know, baseball, softball, wiffle ball, sewer to sewer, single, double, triple, stoop ball,
Scully,
ball.
Your name for bottle caps?
Yes, you'd fill them up with wax, like crayons. You'd melt the crayons.
Yeah, we called the bottle caps in my neighborhood, and the only thing we had to do was to get out of the way when the car started honking the horns at us.
Yeah, and then you would rub the bottle cap on the asphalt to make it nice and slick. And and then I remember, you know, going home, putting the crayons in them and giving them a little weight. We also used to love scaling, you know, with baseball cards, because that was, you know, it was a big deal, scaling and flipping. And, you know, there was nothing like, you know, getting a leaner and, you know, winning the game and winning all those cards that I still wish I had these days. But it was a great childhood. Manhunt, we would play Manhunt, you know, into the wee hours, and bike riding. And I used to ride a unicycle, actually. You know, it was kind of funny. You know, I wanted a bicycle, and my father always had this way of like getting me what he wanted. Like, even before this experience, like, we went through this monster model phase. You know, my friend had like a Frankenstein and a Phantom of the Opera, and, you know, and so on and so forth. So I asked my father for a model, you know, and I said, Dad, you know, I want to get a monster model. Can you get me, like, you know, like a Frankenstein or, you know, something like that? So we went to EJ Corvettes, and he came home, and he's very excited. And he goes, Mike, I got you a model. He goes, and it's not a monster model. It's even better than a monster model. You know what he got me? He got me the raising of the Iwo Jima flag.
Okay.
Because he's a Marine. He was an ex-Marine.
Okay.
And so he gets me, and so anyway, I wanted a bicycle one time, and he brings home a unicycle. And, you know, and I was disappointed at first, but then he, you know, taught me how to ride it. Not that he knew how to ride it, but, you know, the same way you would teach, you know, anybody to ride a bicycle. And he would, you know, stay with me every day for, you know, 20 minutes, a half an hour, you know, before work. You know, I get home from school, and we'd go. And, you know, eventually I learned how to ride it. And, you know, it was pretty cool because I actually rode it in my first show that I was in. And I used to ride it around the neighborhood, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, just, you know.
Yeah, and you were the only one in the neighborhood that could probably. I had a friend who had both a unicycle and an English racer, but I mean, he was so he was the only one that could do that, could bring it down. It would all take a turn, and we'd fall off it, and then he'd ride away. I agree with you about the the neighborhoods. I was right by this giant park, Inwood Park, and we'd just get to go out, and we'd go out with a spool deem in our pocket, and we could play either king, queen against an apartment house wall, or we'd play in the park. Yep. We'd be throwing it forth. We'd go to the basketball courts.
Yeah.
Now, since I moved up here, it was only that we'd drive our children to scheduled activities, whether it be soccer or baseball or basketball. And you lost the spontaneity of that, you know. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And building wagons, that's another thing that I just remembered. We would go like into the lots, we would call it, and those were how, like lots, you know, that weren't built on, and they would, you know, weeds would be growing in there, and people would just deposit garbage in there, and you'd get, you know, a baby carriage, and then you would take the wheels off and the axle off, you know, and the cotter pins, and then you would, you know, we'd go home and we'd get wood and milk boxes out of, you know, made them out of seats, and we'd get rope, and we'd make these wagons, and I mean, how we didn't die, I cannot tell you. We used to go down a hill. Right in the Bronx, in a street, not on the sidewalk, in the street, into a five-corner intersection, and we would, that's where we would get our hill, and we would go down. How we didn't, you know, all the things that we did. I mean, who had bicycle helmets in those days? You know, we used to go riding around, you know, the streets, and we also used to go in St. Raymond Cemetery because they had lots of, you know, hills and it would be kind of cool because there wouldn't be any cars, you know, there, and we would ride around and. It was a great childhood. You know, it just really was.
Those times have changed. Where did you go to high school, and did your interest change then?
I went to Monsignor Scanlon High School. So I had 12 years of Catholic school education. How I survived that, I have no idea. It was corporal punishment. Well, you know, when I got to high school, it wasn't quite as bad. You know, elementary school in St. Benedict's, you know, the physical punishment was a lot more extreme than high school. When we got to high school, they hit, but it wasn't like in the elementary school. And the elementary school was crazy. High school, you know, every once in a while, if somebody really acted out, they might get a shot, but it wasn't anything like St. Benedict's. But did my interest change? At that point, I was into theater. But I didn't want to let any of my friends know that I did theater. So I kept it on the, you know, on the DL. I wouldn't do the shows at school. And there's another thing I regret. You know, I had an older brother, went to Mount St. Michael. And then later on he went to Wyona. And you know, he was 3 years ahead of me in school. So he gave me this advice when I went to high school. He goes, look, don't join any clubs or any sports. Those are for the, you know, fill in the blank. And I was like, okay, all right, yeah, you know, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be any of that, you know. And I lost all of those years. You know, I'm a teacher now, and I tell my students that story every year because I teach freshmen and sophomores. And I tell them, make the most. You could never go back. It's like Billy Joel says, you can never go back there again. You know, I went 4 years of high school, didn't join a sport, didn't join a club, went to school, came home. I was in an outside theater group, though. It wasn't like I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything in school. And, it, you know, high school would have been so much better had I, you know, participated in those things. But, you know, again, I listened to older brother, and I thought I was doing the cool thing. But, you know, in fact, I lost all that. But I was in an outside theater group, and you know, very talented, you know, people, and we had a really great group, and my interest changed to theater at that point, and I wanted to be an actor, and I had every intention on becoming an actor, a movie actor. You know, I liked theater, but it was really film that I was interested in.
Yeah, I wrote for my school paper. By the way, was a brother Gregory, a De La Salle brother, the dean of discipline at Scanlon when you were there?
No. I went there from 74 to 78.
Okay. And then what happened after high school?
I went to, against my will, I went to Queens College. My father forced me to go to college. Didn't want to go. I wanted to go to acting school. and he forced me to go to college. You have to go to college. And I just, like anything else that you don't want to do, I was reluctant. I didn't do any of the work. I didn't know anything about college. And, you know, like I said, my parents were not college educated, and they didn't, you know, I was registering for classes like as a freshman. I look back on it now, and it was a crazy system, because as a freshman, everything was closed out. When I say everything, I'm exaggerating a little bit. There were very few classes open to freshmen. And, you know, I was going to sign up, like I had all these classes. You know, I might be interested in that. Closed, and then I wound up taking classes in things that I had no interest in whatsoever, you know, like anthropology, which was kind of interesting, but those are the only classes left. You know, I remember taking anthropology classes, you know, all the time, and, you know, I only went there for a year, but I didn't, you know, I didn't do my work, I didn't pass many classes, and as a result, you know, I left the school. My father, you know, was angry with me, and I immediately, you know, registered for acting classes in HB Studio in Manhattan. I studied there for a couple of years, and, you know, then eventually I studied, you know, theater with Geraldine Page. And
you mentioned in note to me, and I'm not sure where this fit in, that you were involved in a local performing arts center in Mahopac near me. When did that happen?
That was as an adult, and I started.
So that's way ahead,
you know,
of where we are
that's
now.
That's way ahead of where we are right now, yeah.
How'd you get hooked up with Geraldine Page?
A friend of mine, you know, told me, you know, as I was going to HB, and then I stopped for a little while. I got married very young, and I had, you know, pulled out of acting school, you know, for a while. And a friend of mine told me, he said, hey, Geraldine Page, you know, just announced that she's going to be, you know, teaching classes in Manhattan. And I said, who's that? So he said, you know, she's this great actress. She was nominated for all kinds of Academy Awards and so on and so forth. And, you know, and at the time, The Pope of Greenwich Village was out. And he said, check out this movie. She's nominated this year, Best Supporting Actress for The Pope of Greenwich Village. And, you know, so I went to the video store, you know, I rented, you know, that out. And I watched it, and I was like, holy crap, this woman is absolutely incredible. You know, I watched this scene that just sticks out in my mind, like her son was killed, and she was doing this scene with this guy and this detective, I think it was, and she started talking about her son, and her eyes welled up with tears, and it looked like she was just about to break, and then she just whooshed it away, and she went back, and she was tough as nails. And I said, wow, I've got to try out, you know, for this, because it was by audition only. So I went into the city. There were people, and I'm proud of this. I really am. The room was filled with people. And then I went into the room, and Geraldine was there. And you know, when my number was called, did my monologue. I did something from Prince of the City. And then when I got home, because I lived in the Bronx still, my phone was ringing as I got in. And picked up the phone, and the person said, Geraldine accepted you to study with her. You know, be there next week at, you know, this time. And, you know, and I hung up the phone, and I was absolutely, you know, thrilled to death. And my experience with her was incredible for a couple of reasons. At the time, you know, while I was studying with her, I was sort of had this thing about crying on stage. You know, I was like, you know, I don't think I can do it. You know, every time I kind of do it, I try to do it, and I'm just not getting there. And I think, you know, as a real dramatic actor, you know, you have to be able to do that, you know. So I waited for her after class one day, and she came walking out, and I was waiting sort of in the wing, and I said, hi, and I scared the hell out of her. And I said, I would love to talk to you about acting. And she said, well, I'm going for lunch. Would you like to join me? And I said, I would love to join you. So, you know, we were sitting down in this restaurant in Manhattan, and she said, well, what is it? You know, and I said, well, I have this thing about, you know, crying on stage. Like, I feel like, you know, if you can't, like, really go to that level, I feel like, you know, there's something holding me back, you know. And she gave me some of the greatest advice, you know, about that. And she said, you're thinking about crying, and that's not the way to approach acting. You know, she said, you know, you've got to just you know, go with certain emotions, and you can find those emotions in all of these different ways. And whether it brings you to tears or not, she says, whether you, and don't, you know, play so much to the audience. She said, if you're really feeling pain, the audience will see it in your back, you know. And then I said, you know, I was so fascinated with what you did in Prince of the City, and you know, I explained to her what I explained to you. And then she started to talk to me about what she used when she was doing it, and she did the thing for me right there. And her eyes welled up with tears, and then she just whooshed it away, and I was blown away. I will never forget her, you know, for that. And it was another thing is I always made it a point to introduce myself to any new actors who came to the class, you know, because I said to myself, you never know who, you know, who it is or who it's going to be. And so one day there was this, you know, rather attractive blonde, you know, and she was new and she was sitting in on the class, and I went over to her at the end of class and I said, hi, you know, my name is Mike, and you know, I just saw you here new tonight, and I, you know, shook her hand, and this girl gave me this really firm handshake, and she looked me dead in the eyes with these ice blue eyes, and she said, it's great to meet you. And she said, my name is Rebecca, and I said, oh, okay, well, you know, it's very nice, you know, to meet you too. And but it just stuck out. There was something about her that was, that was, you know, different than anybody else. So the next night, you know, I got home from work, and you know, there was the phone rang, and I couldn't pick it up. At that time, we had answering machines, and the answering machine, I heard her, but I couldn't get to the phone. I was doing something. I forgot what I was doing. And she said, hi, you know, I met you at acting school yesterday at Geraldine's class, and, you know, and you introduced yourself to me, and I looked your name up in the directory, and, you know, I'd like to do a scene with you. You know, this is Rebecca De Mornier. And I'd like, you know, you to come to my apartment in Manhattan if you can, and, you know, work on a scene with me. I have it, you know, picked out, and so on and so forth. So I call her back, and I, you know, I spoke to her a little bit, and she said, you know, if you can come, I'm available this, this, and this. And I had my brother-in-law. I was just newly married, and I had my brother-in-law over, and sister-in-law, and we were having dinner, and I was laughing at her name. I was like, you know, hey, you know, Chris, my one of my acting students, you know, classmates wants me to, you know, act with her in a scene, you know, and her name is Rebecca De Mornier, and he laughs, and his, yeah, right. And I said, no, that's her name, it's funny, you know. And he said, yeah, you're kidding, right? And I said, no, you know, that's her name. And he said, don't you remember Risky Business?
And no, sure.
I was like, holy crap, that's her, that's the girl. You know, so, and my wife said, you're not going to her house and work on a scene. She goes, that's not happening. So, but that was another interesting thing. We did work on the scene, and she was very good. But, you know, as soon as I knew it was her, I got really nervous, you know, which was something that, you know, I don't really get nervous, especially when I perform. I'm kind of, you know, calm. But for some reason, I felt... You know, she was a star at the time, and I wasn't nearly as good as I could have been, because I was nervous. You know, I was starstruck. You know, here's the
sure.
big star, and I'm like this amateur actor, and so we did the scene. It was okay. Could have been a lot better. She was great. You know, but those are the two funny stories about Geraldine Page, and I really, really liked her. She was just a very, very nice woman.
Now, did you during this time get back to writing or no?
All right, I started writing. First thing I wrote actually was poetry. It was the girl I married. She was my childhood sweetheart. We started dating. I was 16. She was 14. And she was my first love. And I don't know, a couple of years later, maybe when I was 18 or 19 or something like that, we broke up, and she broke up with me, which is, that's always like, you know, the worst when you're the one who gets dumped. And I went into this depression like I never experienced in my life. I was always really happy-go-lucky, and I was legitimately depressed. It was the first time I was ever really depressed in my life, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was like weepy, and I was, you know, clingy, and I was all these things, and I, you know, and then one day I would just, you know, and I just sat down and I wrote this poem. And when I was done, I felt a lot better. I called it. It was called What Is Love, and I tried to get these feelings out, and it was a really great poem. People really liked it, you know, and I really liked it. And that was the beginning of, and then I wrote poetry a lot after that. I was writing lots of poems whenever I felt emotional in any way, whether, you know, happy or sad or whatever. I would take out my, you know, notebook and I would write, you know, a poem. Eventually I put those poems into cards and I used to sell them around the Mayapack area, Brewster area, and card stores, independent card stores. And florists, Mayapack Florist sold a ton of those cards. You know,
Now, how'd you get up to this neighborhood if you're living in the Bronx then?
I moved to the Bronx. I moved from the Bronx in 1991. It was just a time for change. And I was working. You know, I had a Wise potato chip route in those days. I had a franchise. I bought a franchise. And I was working in South Bronx, actually, with that. And then I sold the route. And then I opened up a store in Mayapack. It was called The Party's Here. It was on Route 6. And the front of it was Party Supplies. And the back was Party Rooms. And so I opened that up around 1992 or something like that. And I was there for, you know, about 9 months. Right now it's where the bicycle store is, if you know, on Route 6 in Mayapack. Right next to the library, right there.
Okay.
It was great. I mean, before I opened the door, I had 100 parties booked. But that wasn't it. I messed up on my overhead. Like, I rented too big of a place. You know, if I had a small place, if I rented a place that was half the size of that, I would not have gone out of business because it was too big. I had two big party rooms and I had the whole front room. You know, and I envisioned the party supplies, you know, doing better than they actually did. You know, but if I had one party room and just sold balloons, you know, that room would have been booked constantly, and I would have, you know, done okay. But, you know, I lost a lot of money. The money that I had, you know, for my Wise potato chip route, when I sold it, I invested, you know, all into that business and pretty much lost it all in 9 months. It was kind of a tough time for me.
But you wouldn't be where you are now.
That's very true. I would not. I would not be where I am now, for sure. Because that set me off in a whole different path, and then I
was that when you got involved with the performing arts stuff in my whole
back. It was around that time. I decided that, you know, I'd wasted enough time, you know, with theater and these silly dreams of becoming a successful actor. And I just, you know, I had a family and I had a house and I had financial responsibilities. And, you know, I said to myself, all right, it didn't work. And now you've, you know, got to be a grown up and, you know, just go to work. And that lasted about, maybe a month. And then I just had to be around it. So I decided to start an acting school. So, let me see. Now, I don't know the name of it because so many things have changed in Mayapack, but not too far from the bike store in Mayapack. A stone's throw. There's a deli over there. At one point, it was Fathead's Deli. I don't know what it is.
That owned that for Gerard Buckley. Yeah.
Yeah. So upstairs from there was a karate studio or something. Some kind of martial art. And at the time, it was Bernardi's Deli. And I had known Bernardi, and I said, you know, do you use that place upstairs all the time? You know, and he said, no, I only have, you know, these days a week. So I said, would you be interested in renting it to me, you know, one night a week? You know, and he said, yeah, okay, sure. So, you know, he gave me a very reasonable rent, and I put up flyers around the neighborhood, around Mayapack, and decided to teach acting, you know, and so first class was about six students, you know, and it grew, And then I always had this idea, you know, Godspell is like a big, you know, show to me. And I said, you know, I always wanted to teach it. You know, I wanted to direct it. And so every morning at the time I had a different kind of route. I forgot. I think it was Famous Amos. I'm not really sure which one it was. But I used to drive my truck past this little school, St. Joseph's over there in Croton Falls. And I went there one day, stopped there, and I walked in and talked to the principal, and I said, you know, my name is, you know, Mike, and I would like to know if you'd like me to direct Godspell in the school. And she said, I would love for you to direct Godspell in the school. And so I was teaching my acting classes, you know, at night, which it went from adults, and then I had a kid class. And then I was also now directing Godspell at St. Joseph's. And then after I, you know, Godspell, you know, finished, all of the kids from Godspell joined my acting class, and it got, you know, then it was really filled. It was pretty huge. And then I switched it from Limelight Drama School to Limelight Performing Arts Center. And then I did my next show, St. Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I did that at JFK.
Okay.
That stage. And then it went on again, and the following year we did a version of Hair. You know, obviously not the full version of Hair. We did a student version of Hair, and we did it at, there was a clubhouse on Baldwin Place that I went searching for because I knew I needed a home, and I couldn't do it in schools anymore. So,
well, there was a Maybaum Playhouse that was right at Baldwin.
Yeah, there was that place. Now it's abandoned. They might have even knocked it down.
Yeah.
But, you know, I made
That's
a deal
correct.
With the people. I made a deal with the people there. And it became our home for the next couple of years. And we did that. We did a chorus line. We did Pippin. And we did Godspell as our final show. And there were several kids from the first production. And I remember after Pippin, you know, we were talking about Godspell. And it was, you know, we were all at the diner and on Route 6 there in Mayapak. And the kids said, yeah, but when we do Godspell, you have to be Jesus. And I was like, you know, no. And they were like, no, that's the way it has to go out. And I thought about it, and I said, you know what, that would be pretty awesome. So the final show we did was Godspell. We revived it. It was the first show and the last show, and I acted with them. And they were seniors in high school at that point. And it was one of the best experiences in my life. In fact, all of Limelight was one of the highlights of my life, and it will always be. It was, you know, we became a family, and I'm still in touch with those kids now who are now approaching 40.
Wow!
It was a highlight of one of the highlights of my life, and for them, a lot of them, it was like one of the highlights of their lives. So it was a beautiful.
Were you still writing poetry at the time?
At that time, I had already written my first. I had already written, you know, Madness, but I wrote it in screenplay form, and it was called the Hank Lewis Eddy story. I'd written it out, and the first version. I probably started it when I was around 23 or 24, but you know, it kept getting put on the back of my to-do list because of life and, you know, raising a family and paying a mortgage and running a business and, you know, doing all these different things. And then every once in a while I'd get a little time and I would try and, you know, maybe send out a, you know, a letter to, you know, people. And, you know, it just, you know, and it never really, and I always kept going back to it. I always kept going back to it, you know. And then and then when I was 40, it was after I did Godspell. At the time I had a friend, and she, you know, was a teacher, and she came to see the show, and she brought another teacher friend of hers to see Godspell. And afterwards, you know, we were hanging out, you know, the following weekend, and she said, "You should be a teacher." So at the time, I was 40 years old, and I was like, "How could I be a teacher? You know, I'm 40 years old." You know, I don't have any college under my belt. You know, I'd have to start from scratch. You know, I can't. And I had been divorced a couple of years before that. And I moved in with my parents, who just moved into Somers from the Bronx. And I moved downstairs from them. And she said, no, you can do it. She's your natural teacher. She goes, not only did I say it, but my friend said it. I could tell. She said, you should do this. And I thought, you know, it's possible. And she said, no, it's possible. So, you know, I started to think about it, you know, and then, you know, I had to have a talk with my parents because, you know, I was living there and, you know, I had child support payments. And if I, you know, I had to go to school full time. So I asked, you know, my father, I was like, you know, I sat them down. I said, look, I said, you know, if I were to go back to school, you know, could you help me? You know, I'm going to need some help, you know, with, you know, some finances because, you know, I'll do the best I can, you know, to help, but, you know, I'm going to need you if I do this. And I never forget my father was like, it's a great idea. Don't even mention it again. Whatever you need, I got you back.
Oh, that's great.
Without a doubt. And, you know, I didn't have a rent to pay. So I started a DJ business. You know, I, you know, just thought, you know, that's a good way to make cash and, you know, you can make a lot of money in, you know, 4 hours. So I started a business, Let's Party, I think I called it. And, all through college, you know, I was a DJ and I, you know, I made, you know, decent money. I didn't do big gigs. I did one wedding. But mostly I was a, you know, a 40th birthday, 25th anniversary, you know, kids' birthday parties. And, you know, when I worked, you know, in the whole Mayapack area, like, all well, you know, I took ads in the Penny Saver and between me and my father helping me out, you know, I was able to, you know, to get through those years and, you know, and then eventually, when I got married, you know, my parents were older at that point, you know, and they were, you know, really happy for me and, you know, so on and so forth. And they said, well, when are you going to move out? And I said, I'm not totally moving out. You know, I said, you were there for me and I'm going to be there for you. You know, I'm going to live with, I already spoke with, you know, with Lil, and I'm going to live with you a couple of days a week, you know, kind of keep an eye on over here. And then I'm going to live with her, you know, the other couple of days. And she at the time had taken in her mom, who's 91. And so we're both, you know, kind of, you know, she takes care of her mom more than I take care of my parents. My parents are fairly independent, but, you know, they're still in their, you know, my father's, you know, going to be 87. My mom is 85. And they have their issues, and it's good that I'm there. And I think now at this point they kind of, you know, sort of feel really good that I am there. So, you know, in life, that's, you know, your parents take care of you and you take care of them. That's the way I see it.
Hey, and so you went to Manhattanville then?
Mm-hmm. First I went to WCC first.
Okay.
Went there for 2 years and, you know, I was involved in theater there and did a show there, which was the last show I ever did. And Suburbia, it was called, and that was in my senior year, and then I went to Manhattanville, and I took I was an English major, a history minor, and I was a couple of classes shy of a theater minor, because I took a lot of theater classes there, you know, film classes, you know, movie acting classes, screenwriting, you know, and I developed another version of the Hank Lewis Eddy story. It was probably on its fifth version at that point, you know, and it was there that I think that, you know, the kind of light bulb went off where when I first wrote it, it was just like, it was like a boys movie, you know, it was, you know, just boys, you know, it was like grammar school, you know, high school, you know, friends and then college teammates and so on and so forth. But, you know, one of the critiques that came back was, there's no love story in this. And I was like, yeah, I know. It's like, you know, it's like Stand By Me. You know, you don't need a love story. And they were like, no. Stand By Me was kids. you know, this is high school and college. There needs to be a love story here. And it, you know, and as much as you're in love with your product and you become very attached to it, you know, enough people said something to me, like I'd ask them, I was like, hey, you know, I, you know, they told me that I need a love story in this, and they were like, you know, you do. So, you know, I talked to friends and so on and so forth, and so I decided to add the love story to it, which really is an extremely important, you know, aspect of the finished product Madness that I eventually, you know, the current version of it now, but you know, that was at that point, I think I was calling it the Hank Lucetti story. I think I still was calling it that. You know, it was after that where I changed the name to The Man Who Changed Basketball, and then eventually Madness, The Man Who Changed Basketball, because no one knows who Hank Lucetti is. So to put his name on it, you know, would make no sense because there would be no interest in who's Hank Lucetti. So.
But your first book out the door.
Hello? 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 John.
We had a power failure in the studio, so I'm back.
I think he hung up.
Mike?
He just hung up.
Well, I have him here. Could you, boy.
Hello?
Ty, I got you. We had a power failure in the studio. I just called right back in. But I was saying that, I don't know if you got into that, that before I had the, that before that book came out, you had the baseball book that came out.
Yes. Yeah, actually, you know, the baseball book led to, Madness, and I'll tell you how. Before I was going to write the baseball book, there was another baseball story I had, and it was like running around inside my head for 20, 25 years. And I was just about to, you know, to write the book. I said, you know what, I want to write a book. And then right before that, I was a huge Yankee fan. I still am. Not as big as I used to be. But and then I was just very angry at the Yankees for when I went to the new stadium. I wasn't a bleacher creature. Bleacher creatures are dedicated fans who sat in the bleachers every game. You know, but when I would go to a Yankees game, I would sit in the bleachers. You know, that was my preference. And you'd be able to harass the right fielder, and it was just such a great experience, you know, to be there. And I was not happy with the new stadium when it opened. I didn't think we needed one, all of the history, and I just loved the old Yankee Stadium. So I was angry that we were ripping it down. And then I went to the new stadium in 2009. And, you know, bought my bleacher seats and went there. And I was like, wait a minute, where's the bleacher seats? And they move them up and away from where they used to be, and they so that they can charge lots more money for those comfy seats there, right on the edge of the field, and I was so angry. You know, we could no longer, you know, bother the right fielder and the sense of community. And I just felt like, you know what, they don't care about the fans. All they care about is money. And, you know, and it angered me so much, you know, that they were just, the whole new stadium, the feel of it was very corporate to me. And the prices were so expensive. You know, when I was a kid, we used to go to Yankees games, you know, all the time. And, it, you know, we'd take the train there. And, you know, just as kids, and we, you know, go to a game, and you can't do that anymore. The seats are so expensive that, you know, and to me, it's horrible with, you know, what they did to the fans. You know, they, you know, we're the ones who support them. All of our money, we, you know, through cable, you know, through going to the stadium, through buying their merchandise from, and we, you know, are their audience, so they get lots of money from advertisers. So, you know, I said, you know what? The ball players are making way too much money. There's no salary cap. So basically, the way to make a salary cap is to cut the ticket prices in half. And then when people ask for, you know, $300 million, you could say, you know what? You know, since we've lowered the cost to, you know, make it affordable for the families, you know, we can only give you $200 million now. And I think they can live with $200 million. You know, I think that that's definitely fair to do. And it would make it a more fan-friendly atmosphere, a more family-centered environment the way it used to be. A lot of corporates own a lot of those seats, and a lot of them don't even show up. If you look at games, you know, you see those seats empty because, you know, they purchased them, but they're not fans. If they were fans, they'd be filled. So
go ahead.
So I wrote the book, Boycott the Yankees, A Call to Action by a Lifelong Yankees Fan, you know, instead of the baseball, you know, fiction, the novel that I was going to write. And then I was going to write the baseball book. And then I said to myself, you know what? I'm going to take Hank Lewis Eddie's story, and I'm going to turn it into a historical fiction novel. And then I'll write the baseball, you know, story. So that's what I did. And while I was writing it, I changed the name to Madness, you know, the man who changed basketball.
I was in the bleachers at the old Yankee Stadium.
Oh yeah.
For the Giant Colt game that went to overtime. Everyone says was the game that made the National Football League, and for the overtime, I jumped down on the field with a friend, and we're standing on the sidelines. And today they would have arrested us, but the cops said, just move back when they come over here. And,
right.
And I have part of the wooden goalpost in my bedroom. so they lost
yeah.
it. By the way, you may or may not know this, that Boycott the Yankees is available both as a Kindle and as an e-book, as a paperback on Amazon. And the paperback has the listed price of $341. Do you have any idea why that is?
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding at all. And a shipping price of $3.91 on top of the $341 charge. I saw it today.
It's like it's. Are you? I mean, because it should be listed for, I think, like $4.99 or something like that. It's supposed to be or $3.99. You know that.
Well, check it after this.
I definitely am. That is crazy.
You later delved in to fixing the short story, Settling the Score. What's that about?
Settling the Score is about two estranged brothers. It takes place in the Bronx during the 1960s. It's, you know, part of my story, actually. And these two brothers get put on the same Little League team accidentally. And the story takes place over the course of the season and how they had to, you know, work through their issues to be on the team and to contribute. And, you know, it's an older brother, younger brother, you know, situation. And, you know, it's, I think it's a great story. You know, it was published in a magazine, and I, for the life of me, I have a hard time pronouncing it. It's an online magazine, an Italian magazine.
Are you going to do a collection of short stories after Madness, or are you going into another full sports book?
You know, I have that baseball, you know, story that I want to tell, and I've got about 10 outlines for stories that that I want to write. And once I finish the next book, which is the sports book, I complete my sports genre. After that, it's all different stuff. You know, one is a high school teacher, you know, and it deals with you know, a depressed, you know, teenager, you know, a teenager experiencing anxiety and depression. And, you know, I've got another story about Emily Dickinson, historical fiction, and, you know, lots of different, you know, stories that, you know, I want to write, but, you know, I'm a full-time teacher. So in order for me to write it, it takes a while. And I want Madness to be a movie. You know, that's my ultimate goal. I wanted it to be a movie when I first wrote it. I actually wanted to play Hank Luisetti. I never got into that. That's why I wrote it originally. And it was a vehicle for me after seeing, you know, what Sylvester Stallone did with Rocky. I thought, hey, I can do that too. You know, I'm going to become a, you know, writer. I'm going to write a script and I'm going to star in it.
Now, since you and I are the only people listening in the listening audience, certainly, who know who Hank Luisetti was, two questions. First, how did you get the interest that drove the screenplay, and could you tell the audience the story? Who was Hank Luisetti?
Very good question. I mean, we're talking about all these other things. I you know, like I said, I decided that, you know, acting, I was still acting at the time. I was married, running a business, and it was difficult to try and be an actor because, you know, I was working and auditions and, you know, so on and so forth, and I said, you know what, I'm going to do what Stallone did. I'm going to write a movie, and then I'm going to star in it. So I was telling my family about it, you know, at dinner. My wife and I came to dinner at my parents' house in the Bronx, and I said, I want to write a movie, and I want to star in it. And, you know, I'm thinking about what I want to write about. My father said, I have the perfect person for you to write about. So I said, who's that? He goes, Hank Luisetti. I said, who's that? He said, he's probably like one of the greatest basketball players ever. And I said, that's impossible because I've never heard of him. He goes, oh, no. He was, you know, he was the first guy to score 50 points in a game. And it was, you know, during a time when basketball games were, you know, they used to score like 20 points a game. And he invented a layup, and he changed the whole game, and he revolutionized the game. And I was like, well, that's kind of interesting, you know. So I took 2 weeks off from work. At the time, I had a Wise potato chip route, like I said. I hired somebody to run my route for 2 weeks. And I went down to the library in Manhattan, one with the two lions, every day from morning. I get up, like, as soon as that library opened, I was waiting for it to open. I was in, and I was out when it closed. And I didn't know anything except Hank Luisetti, and I didn't even know when he played. My father said the 20s or the 30s. And the librarians didn't know anything about him either. I mean, they, you know, no one ever heard of him. So I started looking through microfilm. I started, you know, searching for his name and card catalogs and all this research. And then all of a sudden I started to come across, you know, newspapers. And I remember on the microfilms, and I'm looking at him, there he is. And I started to track all of this stuff. And I started to print out copies, you know, of things and, you know, these old, you know, copy machines. I think it was paying like 20 cents or 25 cents a copy. It was a lot of money in those days. And I just kept cranking them out. And the more I started to read about him, the more intrigued I was. And then I started to find other articles about him in like Sports Illustrated, you know, years later, you know, in the 70s, I found an article, you know, a couple. And then I started to look in periodicals about him like years after he was, you know, had his career. And I found out that he didn't invent the layup. My father, you know, had a lot of his facts right, but he kind of hiccuped on that one. Hank Luisetti perfected and popularized the running one-handed shot, the fast break, the dribble behind the back, you know, all in an era when basketball was basically like lacrosse is today. It was a school sport. It was an Olympic sport, but it was not a pro sport because it did not have a fan base. It didn't have a fan base because it wasn't that exciting, you know, to play basketball in those days and, you know, to watch a whole game and for him to score 20 points, you know, it was a lot of passing. It was a lot of passing. It was hard to shoot because everything was two hands, two-handed passes, two-handed set shots. You had it to be really
And they had a centered jump after every basket. My father had been the captain of the Regis basketball team. When I started playing as a kid, it was amazing how that he, well, can you do this? Can you do this with one hand now? You know, very interesting.
Luisetti came along, and luckily, you know, his coach, you know, John Bunn from Stanford was, you know, a bit of a visionary, and he allowed Luisetti to use the one-handed shot. And Luisetti was he was 50 years ahead of his time. And the more I read about him, the more I realized that he is, in my opinion, a lot of, you know, unless you have a real discussion with me about it, he's at least the most significant basketball player that ever existed, because after he played in this big game at Madison Square Garden, basketball changed. They call it the night he revolutionized basketball. And once people started to read about this new one-handed shot and this new style of play, people began to imitate Luisetti. All of a sudden, they started to shoot with one hand. They started to shoot on the run. They started to dribble. They started to fast break. And basketball, all of a sudden, got hot. It got hot. March Madness started to heat up because it wasn't officially March Madness at the time, but it was the year after he graduated. It became official. And then after that, you know, it really put the juice in basketball, and that created a fan base, and the fan base, you know, now there's money, and now there's an NBA. Hank Luisetti laid the foundation for March Madness and the NBA, and nobody, not even Michael Jordan, can make that claim. And he was, according to what I've read, he was only 6'3", and I have a picture of him with his hands over the hoop. You couldn't dunk in those days. It was called showboating. They would boo you out of the stadium. But he was only 6'3", and his hands were above, and the basketball were in his hands. They say he used to jump in the air so high and stay up so long that he looked like he defied gravity. And he used to shoot the ball with either hand. He could put the ball in the hoop from anywhere on the court, any position, with either hand. So he was ambidextrous. And they said sometimes he didn't even look at the basket. And they said he used to dribble at such a fast speed that they didn't understand how he maintained ball control. And he was dribbling behind his back. Claire B. said he never saw anybody do more things with the ball than Hank Luisetti. And Claire B. is a legendary
Hall of Fame. Yeah.
Hall of Fame. And talking about Hall of Fame, Hank Luisetti was the first basketball player inducted into the Hall of Fame. That says he's only the second person. The first person inducted into the Hall of Fame when they began, and it's an inaugural year, the first person inducted in was Dr. James Naismith, the inventor of basketball. The second player inducted into the Hall of Fame is Angelo Hank Luisetti. Just goes to show who he was and how significant he was and is to the sport. Now basketball is a global sport. But he was
and
excited
what happened
to see
after his career.
Well, after he graduated, there was no NBA. They used to have some pro tournaments. They were like, you know, played in like armories and dance halls. They weren't, you know, like I said, there was, you know, basketball was not that good in those days. And then, you know, World War II broke out, and he enlisted in the Navy, and he almost died. He contracted spiral meningitis in the Navy. And in those days, it was deadly. But they had just come up with the wonder drug, this sulfur, you know, drug. But sulfur was kind of like chemo. It kind of killed you and the sickness at the same time. So Luisetti, you know, went into a coma for, I think it was something, I forget exactly, I don't want to say, but it was like a month or two. He was in a coma for a long time, dropped down to like 90-something pounds. And he survived the illness, but his heart was affected. And, you know, they said, you'll be fine, but, you know, you cannot play competitive basketball you know, like that would just put too much stress on your heart, and it's not worth the risk. So when the NBA formed, they Louis Eddy was, of course, you know, right on their radar. He was, the, you know, the best player, you know, of the times. And he turned down. The Knicks actually, you know, wanted Louis Eddy because when he performed that, that night in 1936 at Madison Square Garden, he was voted the most outstanding athlete to perform in Madison Square Garden in 1936. What an incredible honor for a person. They awarded that to someone who was not from New York. And, you know, not even the, you know, another thing is that LIU is considered the greatest basketball, you know, team of all time up to that point. They had won 43 games in a row. They were actually asked by the United States Olympic Committee to represent the United States in the 36 Berlin Games, the entire team. Like, instead of going out and looking, they asked LIU to represent the United States. LIU turned them down because there was a lot of Jews on that team, and they had heard rumors about this anti, you know, Semitism in Germany, and they decided that they were going to boycott. That's how good they were. And Louis Eddy, you know, single-handedly, you know, stopped them dead. They had no idea what to do with him. You know, it was, again, they were playing with somebody who was 50 years ahead of his time. And the fans at Madison Square Garden were cheering for him, which is another, it's, you know, the story really plays out like a modern day, not a modern day, like a true life Rocky. It's just it's a great story. I always loved the story. I always believed in the story, and I believe that it's going to be a movie one day. You know, if people are listening, you know, on the radio station and they have any connection to, you know, or they want, you know, they would like to maybe start off with a documentary. You know, I know it's going to happen. I've got some people interested in it now, but, you know, the way the movie business is, it's a very, you know, difficult industry. But to me, the first person who gives me a solid, you know, says, you know what, I have the money, I want to make the movie, you know, that's the person I go with. So I fully intend, that's why I have not started my next, you know, project yet. My book manager, you know, has told me several times, you know, you need to start your next book. And I just, there's something in my gut that's just telling me, like, I don't want to give up on this story. I want this to be made into a movie. I want to see this on the screen. So I tell everybody about it, and, you know, and that's how I've actually made contacts, you know, with people in the movies, because, you know, I'm an English teacher. I'm not, you know, a Hollywood, you know, person, but, you know, I do book talks a lot, and I always mention it, and, you know, there's always somebody, you know, comes up to me inevitably and said, hey, you know, my cousin, you know, has a, you know, an independent movie company, or, you know, this or that or whatever. And I've got, you know, several people that, that I have some interest in the story. I'm just waiting for the right person who's as motivated and believes in this story as much as I do. To me, it's a natural hit. It's a moneymaker, because March Madness is, you know, the second most popular sporting event in the country. And basketball is global. Football isn't global. You know, football is, you know, American, you know, maybe Canada, you know, it's not. Basketball has become global. They play it everywhere, all over Europe. They play it everywhere. So there's your, you know, your international audience. And then, you know, in America, March Madness is hugely popular, you know, and then, you know, it would have a life of its own, you know, on ESPN or the History Channel, you know, during March Madness every year, you know, so, you know, you run it, you know, during that time. So to me, it's a natural, you know, that for anybody, for a business person, you know, in the movies, looking at something, you know, is this movie going to, you know, be successful? You know, there's all these avenues as to why, but I just have a gut feeling. It's just a great story. You know, Louis Eddy is an unknown who did something magnificent, you know, in the world.
I agree.
Of,
you mentioned
basketball.
36 Olympics. The great basketball and football announcer, Marty Glickman, was a member of the Olympic track team. When he went over there, mm-hmm. They did not let him run because the the coach, Avery Brundage, decided that Jesse Owens had already embarrassed Hitler, so he didn't let the two Jewish guys run. And Marty Glickman said that was the worst thing that happened to him in sports. He never,
you know, I thought I heard that story where he was getting where the coach was getting pressure from the Germans, and that's why he didn't run. So I actually have an inaccurate.
According to what I read in a bunch of things, it's quite possible it was both ways. But that was after, it was after Jesse Owens and supposedly Brundage told him that we've given him enough, you know, and so what's next for you? You're going to wait for the movie, or are you going to go ahead with the other book?
You know, I'm very busy with you know, promoting Madness. My calendar, you know, on my phone, anything, you know, with book related, I put in red, and my calendar is just lighting up with red. I have book talks, and you know, next weekend I've got a bunch of things next week. Next weekend I'm doing a book talk in a Montgomery books in Montgomery. I'm doing a book talk there. On the next day I'm going to be on another radio show. It's just nonstop. I've got so much happening with the book, so. You know, I'm going to continue with it. Like I said, my ultimate goal, I'd love to get into schools too. That's another, you know, thing that I'm working on, you know, and not to say that it would be necessarily a curriculum read, although there are schools right now, you know, as a new trend in education where kids are reading in, you know, their own books, like individual books, and instead of the whole class reading one book. It hasn't happened in my school. And as an English teacher, I can't imagine. It's such a different way to teach than how I teach. You know, we're all like I feel like I'm an expert on the books that I teach. So I'm hitting things that I believe, you know, but if everybody's reading a different book and I haven't read all of those books, but nonetheless, it's still a trend going on. So I guess it could enter curriculum in that way. But if it were to wind up on summer reading lists or outside reading lists, you know, so we're all reading this book in class, but here's a list of books that, you know, if you're interested, you can read and do some work on. So I'm hoping to get it into schools, you know, and that way. So my focus for this year, my goals for this year are, of course, you know, get the movie made and, you know, send it out to schools, you know, have a letter and you know, I'm working on that now. It's an arduous task when you think about it. You know, I have a list of all the schools in the country, and there are, as you can imagine, thousands and thousands of schools. So I'm just looking at high schools. But, you know, to, you know, even, you know, send out, you know, to a high school, you know, a mailer to a high school, you know, each one is roughly a dollar, you know, especially because a stamp costs 55 cents. So,
sure.
So for me to send out a mailer, I got it down to about 83 cents. But, you know, I want to send out 300, you know, at a time. You know, so every time I send out 300, it's nearly $300. You know, so, and you know, trying to find out the name of the English department chair, otherwise it just, and I want to handwrite that on. You know, I want to handwrite like the name of the department chair, because when I get stuff in the mail, I mean, if it's just like a computer printout and it's an envelope, I usually, you know, toss it. But if it has, you know, my name on it handwritten, I might open it, you know, and then if I'm hoping I get, you know, through that, and then hopefully, you know, they'll look at it. And the book has won 3 literary awards so far, a contest. You know, it's won a New Apple Award, it's won a Reader's Choice Award, and it's won an International Book Award. And
that's terrific.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that, you know, that persuades them to you know, say, hey, you know, it's maybe we'll let our put this on a reading list, and we'll have our students, and you know, I'm sending out, you know, I'm offering them a free copy. So even if I send out, you know, books, that's even more of an investment. So it's an arduous task. It's harder than I thought it was going to be, but then again, most things are, right? You have it in your mind, and then when you actually go and do it, you know, it's, but you know, slow and steady wins the race. You know, you just have to keep trying, which that's what I do.
We've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
You know, I guess, you know, in order to be able to be an author and to have a full-time job, and as I've explained to you, I owned my own business. I had a Wise Potato Chip route. I had an Eagle Snacks route. I had a business in Mayapack, you know, the party rooms. I was a DJ. There were even a couple of other things that, you know, I did when I was younger. I had a party, and party entertainment group. You know, I used to, you know, I had one of those things. And when I became a teacher, I was like, wow, it's the most challenging job that I've ever had. It's incredibly, you know, you're doing 5 live shows a day. And you know it's hard to hide behind a computer. I'm not putting any other career down. I'm just basing it on the careers that I've had. The amount of work you know it takes to teach and the amount of energy you know you give out in a day is pretty incredible. Like when people look at teachers, they're like, oh, they're off all the time. And you know what? If we weren't off all those days, I don't think there would be many teachers because unless you stand before a classroom of 30 kids and you teach them and you're trying to teach them things that they don't want to, usually they don't want to learn, you know, about it. Most of the kids don't want to read the books. Most of the kids don't want to write the assignments. Most of the kids. So you've got to entertain them. You've got to try hard to make them like what they're doing. You've got to, you know, maintain the standards of, you know, the New York State. They have to be able to pass certain tests. You have to be able to handle, you know, discipline issues, you know, effectively, you know, so it doesn't turn into a – there's just so much going on. You've got to, you know, look at, you know, if there are kids who look depressed or kids who might have bruises. There, you know, you've got to be on all the time. When you're a teacher, you have to be on all the time. In order to do that and to write – there were things that, you know, I had to change in my life, you know, if I want to be able to do this. So I'm up between 3:45 and 4:15 every day. That's summers, that's days off, you know, snow days, holidays, Christmas Day, you know, any day. And I'm up and I'm working, you know, I don't watch TV. I don't even listen to radio when I'm in the car, because when I'm in the car and my commute to work or wherever I'm going, I'm thinking about, you know, how am I going to promote the book? You know, when I'm writing the book, you know, my next chapter, what am I going to write about? How am I going to do it? How am I going to get through my day? What kinds of things do I have to do today? How can I be effective, you know, when I'm working? You know, when I'm at work, you know, when I get a prep period, I'm working really hard. Like, I don't socialize, you know, very much at work. You know, I use my prep periods to grade and to, you know, answer emails. And you know, I'm working all the time. And it's the only way. No one's, you know, it's difficult to write a book. You know, it's, you know, to be able to manage being a teacher and being an author, you know, promoting the book, you know, maintaining family, you know, obligations and spending time with friends, you know, things like TV and radio and video games and things like that. You know, those are the things that and sleep. You know, for a while I was running on, you know, 4 to 5 hours of sleep. Now I don't do that anymore because I was able to do that for about a year. But I was tired all the time during the day. I was tired, you know, a lot. So I feel like now I need at least 6 hours. And if I can get 7, even better. So if I've got to shut down at night and go to bed at 9 so I can get up at 3:45, that's my goal. You know, I try to do that. So, you know, so I sacrifice, you know, other things for things that I want to do. It's just, you know, it's... But I love it, and it's not easy, but, you know, I'm motivated to make it happen, and so that's why I do it.
I agree, and I understand it because I'm much the same way. Thank you very much, Mike. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. I had a great time talking with you.
Send any comments or questions to me about the show at johnmack13@gmail.com, and be sure to join me next week for my conversation with Charles Mann. Go to my website, johnmack13.com for the Earls of previous shows. My book's available at Amazon as Mike's, although one of his costs $341. Now, in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after a Mets win, put it in a book. And until next time, as they say in the old neighborhood, see ya. But go off again with the Eagles. Amazon, play Taking It Easy.
Here's Take It Easy from your library on Amazon Music.
All right, John, if you're there, I'm going to sign off, and I'll talk to you soon.
Yes, be well, and thanks again, Mike.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.